Hi, this is Barry List of Informs, and you're listening to Informs Today. In several of our podcasts with those in analytics and big data, we've heard that industry and government need to pay mind to consumer privacy. My guest today, journalist Adam Tanner, addresses this sensitive topic in his new book. It's entitled What Stays in Vegas: The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It. It's published by Public Affairs. Adam, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I talk with a lot of numbers crunchers in these podcasts, and none has started a book quite the way you have. Please tell us about your experience in the former East Germany and how it relates to online privacy today.
So in the mid-1990s, I had the opportunity to travel fairly widely in the former communist Eastern Europe. And in one day in 1988, I was subsequently able to find that 10 Stasi agents followed me around Dresden, what was then East Germany. And they monitored what I did on a moment-by-moment basis. And so there's a log, there's 60 pages about a single day of my life in Dresden, which is this great art capital, but as it was in 1989, a year before the Berlin Wall opened. And what they knew was, hour by hour, minute by minute, what I was doing. And so if you read the file, it says things like, 10:03, he arrives at the Semper Opera. 10:37, he leaves the building. 10:39, he's looking at a map. 10:41, he's still looking at a map and asks for directions. And it goes into great detail on this kind of log basis of what I was doing. In some cases, it has supplementary information or reports that are generated about me. So, for example, at one point, I stopped at a factory and I asked, is this the factory which was once a slaughterhouse during World War II? And that was the slaughterhouse where Kurt Vonnegut was interned, and then his novel Slaughterhouse Five was the basis for that.
Sure.
And I speak to the guard for a minute or two, and the Stasi was so suspicious that they generated a second report, and they said, send an agent, find out what this guy was up to. So this is from the Stasi file on me that was released. In fact, the code name was Kiefer, or Pine Tree. So this is something I was able to obtain years later after the unification of Germany. But the interesting thing about it is that even though they had 10 people physically following me, taking surreptitious photographs, conducting subsequent interviews, they didn't really understand much about what I was doing. And so what exactly was I doing at the time? Well, I was writing a travel guidebook, The Frommer's Eastern Europe and Yugoslavia, on $25 a day. But that concept just seemed alien to them. They found it hard to understand how someone would want to review hotels and restaurants and provide practical information. And so there was quite a disconnect in the report as to how it pertained to me. I became interested in this topic that's portrayed in the book, What Stays in Vegas, because today, thanks to the power of data analytics, there is more detailed information about hundreds of millions of people than there is really about my file back in that time done in a manual way, which didn't provide a lot of insight.
So remind us about the advertising campaign that led to the title of your book and why you chose this title.
So the book is titled What Stays in Vegas. The advertising campaign followed from the 2001 attacks, which really hurt tourism across the United States, and Las Vegas was one place that suffered as well, perhaps especially so, because many people found it frivolous to go and gamble and go to shows and just take it easy in Las Vegas after such tragic events as happened in September of 2001. So the city wanted to come up with some kind of campaign to attract people, and the advertising campaign was called What Happens Here Stays Here, which in popular parlance is now known to many as What Happens in Vegas Stays in Vegas. So the title of the book kind of asks this broader question: when it comes to personal data, what would stay in Vegas or what would stay in any place? What is out there and what is spread and what is still private in today's internet era?
Now, we're going to segue here to something very much related to the field of analytics, which many of our listeners will know about. One of the seminal books in this growing field is called Competing on Analytics. It's by Tom Davenport and Jeannie Harris, and it has an introduction by a man named Gary Loveman. He talks about using analytics in Las Vegas, and he plays a key role in your book. Who is he, and why is he so important?
So Gary Loveman is a former Harvard Business School professor or associate professor whose best-known work in academia was the concept of lifetime value of customers, that if you can get someone to be a lifetime value of customer, a lifetime customer, they're going to be incredibly valuable to your business. So someone buying pizza, for example, might only be worth a dollar or two a slice today, but over a lifetime, they may be worth $7,000 or $8,000. And then if you're talking about cars or someone buying aircraft for corporations, incredibly more valuable. During his time at Harvard Business School, Gary Loveman then began to do some consulting for what was then called Harrah's and is now Caesars, the world's, what has become the world's largest casino company. And he brought this concept of lifetime value to the casino business. Back when he started in the late 1990s, initially as a, well, he was in the mid 1990s, he was a consultant. In the late 90s, he became the chief marketing officer, and then he became the CEO of the company, where he remains today. Back then, there was a lot of what the industry calls promiscuity amongst customers. That means they would go to one casino tonight, maybe somewhere else the next day. There was very little customer loyalty. And through data, he wanted to do all he could to bring up loyalty amongst customers, to capture that same business over and over again in Las Vegas and other casinos owned by the company.
And what kinds of things did he introduce in terms of Las Vegas tracking customer behavior, both in consumers and in general, not only about their gambling habits, but about their individual consumer behavior?
So, in essence, he wanted to and did very significantly bolster the amount of information gathered about people through the loyalty program and the amount of information that was then interpreted and used for marketing purposes. So the key concept here is that if people opt into the system and join the loyalty program, they're going to get significant rewards in terms of free food, free meals, if they're very valuable customers, tickets to events, maybe even free chips and so on to gamble with. And people have to opt into the system. And I found this an interesting model because in today's world, there are many things in which data is gathered about you without a choice. But this is a more traditional modern loyalty program where if you join, you'll use the card throughout the casino. So you sit at a slot machine, you enter the loyalty card, it records to the penny how much you've gambled. You stop to have a meal, you hand the card to the waiter, you'll get a slight break on prices right there, and it'll know what kind of foods you like. Perhaps later you'll buy some tickets to go to a show. It'll know what show you like. So there's an incredible amount of data across different fields within the walls of the casino that they're going to know about you if you join the loyalty program.
And as you say, it's opt-in rather than opt-out, which clearly gives the consumer greater control.
That's right. And so that's a choice that we often do not have in today's consumer environment. If you prefer to gamble anonymously, you can go and do that. They may ask to confirm your age, but beyond that, you can put cash on the table, gamble, and leave. But at the same time, you're not going to get the rewards that the casinos give to those who are their most valuable customers. Whereas in so many internet transactions, so much of the things we do in the world today, our information is tracked and gathered without giving us a choice, or really without giving us insight as to what is happening with that data.
And what is the actionable data, as people might say? What can Caesars do with the data that it's gathered about you?
So firstly, they need to figure out who are the valuable customers. And by very closely tracking people, they discovered categories of people that had prior not been considered very important. For example, a retiree, an elderly woman who goes quite frequently and doesn't spend that much money in a casino, perhaps someone who goes and spends $70 or $80 in an evening at a casino but comes 50 or 100 times a year, well, that person actually turns out to be a valuable customer. But in the traditional ways of tracking people or kind of observing through more conventional means without computers and without player cards going into machines and something, they didn't really draw any attention. But this whole class of people became very important when they realized, oh, well, they're spending $5,000-$10,000 a year. Let's give them some perks such as free drinks or access to lounges or things that make them feel special, and then they're going to bring all of their business to us, and that's going to benefit both sides of the equation.
Let me remind our listeners that this is Informs Today with Barry List. You're listening to an interview with journalist Adam Tanner about consumer privacy in the internet age. Turning to social media, what kinds of information are users of sites like Facebook unknowingly giving away when they use their like button?
Well, if you, I don't know if we're talking about signing on by Facebook, but if you sign on to other sites via Facebook, the site to which you're signing on, which has nothing to do with Facebook, all of a sudden gains the insights about you that can be discerned from social media that might otherwise be closed to them. And there's a lot of information that one can discern from social media, even just by association or by patterning, things that perhaps some of your listeners already know about. But, for example, who you associate with on Facebook can give great insight as to who what kind of person you are, and sometimes those are pretty intimate things. So, for example, who you associate with could indicate your sexual proclivity. It could give a very strong indication that you might be gay, for example. Or your likes can give a similar indication. Politics, religion, other things can be inferred by these inferences, and not only very direct ones like you like the Democratic Party or you like the Gay Men's Chorus, things that are much more obscure but in patterns would be clear as to what you're interested in. And so it makes for somewhat of a more confused situation when you're dealing with it as a business. What can you ethically use for marketing purposes, and what should you avoid, even if you have the opportunity to see that information?
And there's a clear implication that users of social media sites aren't quite grasping that they're giving away personal information that they might not want to share.
I think that the problem is that any one piece of information you provide may seem completely innocent, and those who are not involved in this kind of data analytics business in great detail would not understand that. It's sort of like building a mosaic with individual tiles. If you give out an individual tile today and another tomorrow and another, it seems like you're giving almost no information, but over time you've built an entire picture of your life, an entire mosaic. And so I don't think people realize how clever data scientists are today and how much insight they can gain by these many little pieces of data that are provided over time.
Now, one startling report that illustrates this, it appears in your book, you talk about a Harvard professor who cross-referenced data from different databases to identify people's names just based on things like medical records. In other words, the researcher was looking at something without a name and was able to determine who this person is. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is Professor LaTanya Sweeney. She's just now finishing a leave as the chief technology officer at the FTC in the United States, the Federal Trade Commission. She did research years ago in which she looked at the hospital exit records that are anonymized that were provided by the state of Massachusetts. And she looked at those exit records and cross-referenced them with voter registration lists. And just using very simple data, which was zip code, date of birth, and gender, she was able to identify 87% of the people. Amongst the people that she was able to find the medical exit records for was the then governor of the state of Massachusetts, William Weld.
And this so was even though there's a HIPAA provision that is supposed to guard privacy, she was able to find these in the public domain.
So, well, this is HIPAA are the privacy regulations that govern medical data, but HIPAA applies to data that is named, where your name and very clear details are there.
Ah.
The problem is that when the data is anonymized, even if not fully anonymized, it is then not covered by those health privacy guidelines. And so it's sort of like kryptonite, which is lethal in its pure form, but if you put it into a steel box, then you can trade it and carry it around and do whatever you want with it. So the steel box is the anonymization of the health data. The question is, can researchers break the box open through re-identification technology? And that's some of the issues that are raised with data, with this massive amounts of data that people now have at their fingertips.
So this promise that researchers make to their subjects that by anonymizing they know nothing about them as individuals, all of a sudden that promise might not be a true promise.
And I don't think it's maliciously made by the companies or by those people that have the data. I think many people do not have the sophistication of your listeners to understand how powerful data analytics are and how powerful the cross-referencing of different data sets are. So one thing that seems totally obscure, like how could you ever figure out from this small bit of information when you have a few clues from a couple of different other data sets, then it becomes much easier, and that's where the vulnerability lies.
Now, you mentioned earlier that sexual orientation is one piece of personal information that online users might unintentionally give away. Do you want to give some examples of other things?
Well, there are marketing companies, for example, that specialize in ethnic, in figuring out ethnic origins and ethnic, which generation, are you a first generation Indian American, second generation this or that. Now, of course, many of these things are perfectly fine. They're used for marketing purposes. So, for example, if you're a long-distance telephone company or a cable TV provider and you have movies in Philippine language or Hindi or in Russian, and you want to find those people of those origins, you want to find early immigrants that would speak that language, that's what a lot of that stuff can be used for. But at the same token, the same kinds of techniques could be used for purposes that are less benign, even for discrimination if one wanted to do that. But by studying the names, by studying the patterning, you could figure out the ethnic origins. And then other sensitive areas would obviously be medicine, politics, political affiliation, religion, things of that nature. So there's a lot of things, the same techniques could work across the board and provide great insights, but in some cases would be uncomfortable, I think, for the consumers whose information is gathered.
And one of the observations that you make in the book is that it's not simply written data, but video cameras. So, for instance, what's happening with all those video cameras in places like the casinos you were talking about earlier?
So, video cameras is an interesting one. Casinos have more video cameras in private or privately owned space than anywhere else. There might be 3,000, 4,000, even 5,000 cameras in a large Las Vegas casino. Half or so are looking at the clients, half or so are looking at the staff. They have only 5 or 6 people in the room looking at all these cameras. They'll go back in time and rewind the digital file to see if something happened. But again, even digital, if you look around throughout the world, there's an increasing number of these cameras everywhere. And in many cases, they're entirely benign, but could be used in ways that would be more uncomfortable. I was thinking just a few weeks back, I was visiting Sicily, and I was in some small towns in the Italian countryside. And I saw that there were video cameras in churches, which were unattended. And sure, that's great for preserving that no one steals the paintings, for example, from the wall. But if they were to be used for observing who's coming regularly to church and keep a tally on the parishioners, that would make people feel uncomfortable. So a lot of the technology is very useful for its core use, but in the end, could be used in different ways that raise questions about where the limits might be.
And when it comes to limits, if a person's arrested and, let's say, acquitted, even so, they've had a mugshot taken of them. And what could be the consequences of having your mugshot taken in this era of internet searches?
So there's a whole chapter in the book about the mugshot business, so to speak, or the online mugshot websites. And the way that these businesses evolved was as follows. Mugshots are publicly available documents, and they long have been. In the olden days, before computerization was widespread, in order to obtain that mugshot, you'd have to go down to the town courthouse or the police house and ask for a copy of it. So it was fairly cumbersome. And of course, if there was a celebrity arrested or someone famous, a politician, you would see that mugshot in circulation in a newspaper or on television. But nowadays, there are companies such as BustedMugshots.com, which is featured in one of the chapters in the book, that gathers millions of mugshots. In the United States, in any one year, there will be 12 or 13 or 14 million Americans that are arrested, only some of whom are actually convicted of a crime. And they code the photo, they put it up on the internet, and often searches will turn up this mugshot very prominently for an average person. What the mugshot companies also had been doing was then offering the people who had been arrested the opportunity to remove the photo from the internet for a convenience fee, something like $100. So it wasn't straight blackmail, because it wasn't a threat that we will do something unless you pay us. They actually did it. They posted the photos and then subsequently said, well, we'll remove it if you pay us for it.
And
so
that's
this is an example of how you could use personal data in a way that was humiliating or damaging to someone's reputation.
Data miner Claudia Perlich recorded a podcast with us a couple of years ago, and she uncovered a fraud. Tell us about that.
So she works for a company now called Distillery that was formerly called Media 6 Degrees, and they help companies find to place ads for companies, find the right websites based on patterns. The interesting thing is that she doesn't look for, I want to serve ads to John Smith, and I know all about John Smith. She wants to find people who are going to buy sneakers, and she looks at patterns through people who buy sneakers go to this website, then to this website, and finally arrive to the sneaker website and make the purchase. And so then for her sneaker client, she'll say, well, here's the sites to put your ads on, because here's where likely purchasers will go. So that's based on big data of patterning between people who go from site to site. The problem when you don't have individual names is that the system can be rigged. And so what she and some colleagues discovered was that there were sites that no one had ever heard of that were attracting huge amounts of traffic. People would go to this obscure site, then this obscure site, and all of a sudden they arrive at Nike or Bank of America or other important sites. And so it would seem logical to put ads on the obscure sites because they seem to have massive amount of traffic that would end up at these other sites. And that traffic appears to be bought or fraudulent, BOT, bought traffic or fraudulent traffic.
If I think that I'm making a purchase of information that I can use, and it turns out that this information I'm buying is incorrect.
So, in other words, if you are the ad department of Nike and you say, we need to put ads out there to get people, drive people to our site, you turn to a savvy company like Claudia's company, and they will tell you where to go. The problem was that many people had incentives for the system to continue as fraudulently as it was, because many people's bonuses were conditioned on reaching as many potential customers as possible. So if you turned off the false traffic, you might lose 20% of your traffic. It seems like you were not as effective as some of the competitors. And so that raised questions. Or bonuses could be conditioned on generating lots of traffic. And to go and point out, well, actually, you're buying all this fake traffic, that made a lot of people happy. So the chapter about Claudia Perlich talks about her background from the most unlikely world of advertising, which is the former East Germany, which we briefly talked about before,
right,
where advertising was banned entirely, onto the front lines of today's advertising, internet-targeted advertising, in which there's a lot of things that can still go wrong, and that's what happens in the chapter.
We only have time for one or two more questions. So what is the fine line between acceptable business practices when it comes to learning about customers and invading privacy?
Well, the fine line is quite blurry. It's hard to tell what is exactly an acceptable practice. So the standard I think businesses should embrace is one of openness. They should tell customers when they're gathering data in simple language and give them a choice as to how to respond. And I think those companies that are most honest and most transparent about their activities will win in the long term, because you can fool people for amount of time, they don't realize what you're doing to them. But when it gets out there, there'll be a lot of public anger. And so it's not a direct parallel, but when people realize that credit card security was not what it should have been at Target, there was a lot of anger from the public about it, and the amount of sales and cost to Target was in the hundreds of millions of dollars when people realized that there was all that information out there that was not sufficiently protected. And I think the same could happen in the future with companies who are not open about their data practices. So businesses should let the customers know what the practices are, how they gather the data, how they use it, and give them some choice in how the data is used.
And finally, what advice do you have for consumers about protecting their privacy? And here I'm thinking about using websites like personal.com.
So there's a whole appendix in the book that gives a whole series of suggestions. But in general, I advocate that people think about this issue and think about what level at which they're comfortable at sharing data. And everyone will have a different standard. There'll be some people who are very open about sharing almost everything about themselves, and there's others that will want to protect their information much more carefully. So the first path is to think about what am I comfortable sharing and what are the practices of the companies that I deal with. It does take a bit of effort to figure out what companies are doing because they're not always transparent. The privacy policies are hard to understand. But I think it's worth the effort to understand what are the potentials, what could happen with your data, and then set your own standards using some of the privacy tools I talk about in the book. And we saw just recently, for example, with the leaking of celebrity photos that were intimate, that those things were not properly encrypted or not sufficiently protected, even in the use by the end consumer. And so one may think, well, if I have intimate information, either of photos or tax returns or medical documents, maybe I want to encrypt them or store them in a different way. Maybe I want to use these different kinds of services. So that's something I talk about in the very end. But the end result for me is, you know, with open businesses, giving customers a choice, both sides will benefit and minimize the damage that could happen.
And do you still use social media and e-commerce?
So I certainly use e-commerce a lot. Social media I use to promote my book mostly, but it's also a choice of how much time one has in the world. So I live in a busy university environment where there's a lot going on all the time, and so that keeps me pretty busy, giving me less time to engage in social media. But I certainly have Twitter. I have a book page for What Stays in Vegas on Facebook and so on. But again, it's not. I have no one prescription for everybody as to what everyone should do. I think everyone should do what they're comfortable with, but you've got to understand what the whole system is like and what can happen with your data. And when there's some better understanding, then you can make an informed choice.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Adam Tanner, author of What Stays in Vegas. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
And thank you for listening to Informs Today, a podcast by the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more information about analytics, operations research, and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.